Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. So as we get into 2018, I thought this would be a good time, especially with the Survivor and reality TV off-season in general, to revisit some of our favourite shows from the past. Those of you who have been listening to us for a long time may know that there's a little show called The Genius that we're both quite partial to, and we decided to come back and dissect that once again with a very stable genius. It's one of our favourite guests of all time.
Sorry, I barfed through your intro.
Quite appropriate. I can't fault you at all. But today we're going to be discussing one of our favourite games from The Genius with one of our favourite guests, and that's the inimitable Miles Nye. Miles, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Well, the fact that I get to talk about stable geniuses is dragging me down a little bit, but
right.
I'm doing okay. I'm surviving.
Yeah, not my genius. My genius needs a min, Sang or Dong, and that's the genius to me and always will be. I just did my first full rewatch of Rule Breaker since it aired.
Oh wow! So that's we'll get into how that is different now from when I assume you first watched it 2 or 3 years ago now.
Yeah, whenever it was broadcasting.
Yeah, it's, and as I took you to task for last time, it's scary to think that this show was just out there for so long and so many of us just didn't realize it. And so now when we go back, there are discussions about this from early 2013, which I wish I was there from day one, because I need the
bothers,
show in my life.
You know, it seems like maybe you just weren't, like, I don't know, using Bing search terms correctly or something. There might not have been a Bing, but I found the English language discussion for this show when it was broadcasting live, and it was on Bother's Bar, which is a UK website associated with Brig Bother, who does great game show stuff. And David J. Bodycombe, the creator of Only Connect, has appeared on some of Brig Bother's YouTube content. So that's I'd love to be friends with that circle of activity. And in the comments section, people were talking about The Genius and Rule Breaker. And there was one commenter whose handle was XR. And XR's comments were so highbrow and intelligent and, you know, detailed in thinking of the games and the rules and the production value and the editing and the presentation. I was like, wow, whoever XR is like, just to be able to talk about a show with that level of intelligence. But that's where I was exchanging ideas, reading mostly, but I definitely posted. I wasn't just a straight up lurker.
Yeah, I know the show is somewhat popular in Korea, and I imagine there's a big Korean language following for the show and has been since day one. But
yes.
For us Anglophones looking in from the outside, that discussion has been taking place in tiny comment sections of unrelated
yes.
forums over the
yes.
years, just scattered
yeah.
across the internet. and I remember, as The Genius Grand Final was airing, we were so excited to finally get to watch this live. It was almost
yes.
like this cult following on Twitter, doing our best to keep spoilers away from outsiders who would come to the show later.
Mm-hmm.
And just frantically refreshing, like, Bundedly Umptious's Tumblr page, waiting for the links to finally go up. Like, it was.
Oh, yeah. That's yeah, what I do. That's what I do.
It was inspiring and sad in equal measure, almost. But I'm so glad that the show is something that I've got to see, and that this small community, whatever it is, that has grown up around it, has
yep.
That I'm part of that, because that's really been great. Not to sound elitist at all, Miles, but to my money, it's, if you can appreciate The Genius, it's meant for a, I don't want to say a smarter audience, but a more niche audience maybe than most reality shows. Like, it does appeal on a different level.
Yeah, it's not for everyone. I think the last time I really put my foot in it, when I tried to compare, like, The Genius to The Wire, and that led somewhere, you said, I'm not eager to revisit. Let's set that aside. But, you know, if you, or, you know, a sculpture, a beautiful sculpture, like one particular piece of sculpture, or like three that were on the side of the same temple, like if you went to the museum every day and looked at those all the time, people would be like, oh, wow, that person's so cultured and appreciates beautiful things. But just because it's a Korean celebrity competition show, the outside world doesn't view it the same way that we do.
Yeah, and I think now that Rob and Steven have brought this to the mass market, I don't know if it's hipster enough for us anymore. So if you have suggestions for a more niche...
Dom and Colin brought it to the mass market.
Well, I'd like to think so. We were the first step in that process, but now it's fully gone international. If any of you know of a more niche, more inaccessible game show that we can hold as our pride, then let us know, because we want to jump on board there. But now, very happy to be talking about The Genius again.
Yeah, I guess Million Dollar Mind Game for an American show. That's the one that's even more niche, I think. I think the whole thing is on YouTube.
Okay, I know the last time I had you on, you gave some recommendations for shows that people should check out. We'll definitely do that again for people who didn't listen to that, although if you didn't, why not? Go back and listen to it now.
It's I don't want to listen to a lot of talk about The Genius. I just want them to talk about one main match, maybe the one from Rule Breaker Episode 1. That's just the right amount for me.
It's like, I don't know about this Miles guy, but Food Chain, I'll listen for that. Yeah,
I'm a Food Chain stan. You promised me you'd explain to me what a stan is. I don't know what a stan is. I'm 37 years old.
So you've seen these fans on Twitter who, and other places too, who get very intense, shall we say, about their fandom for certain people. And it just refers to them. And if I am a Miles stan, as I told you before, I will not get as creepy and obsessive as they do, hopefully. But just being in your orbit, Miles, is always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for the usage, but I want the etymology, the derivation. Like, why? What is the morphology? Why is it a stan? Was there a reality contestant whose name is Stan? Is it a relation? Is like a reference to like Pakistan or Turkmenistan?
I really
don't know. Those are not wisecrack questions.
Are you familiar with the musical artist known as Eminem?
I know that there is one. I know that he won an Oscar and he couldn't perform his song at the awards because it was all cusses.
You know of him, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So he had a song called Stan where the plot line is some fan gets over-obsessed with a celebrity, starts bombarding them. Yeah. So
that's a great answer.
You can see the
time. That's a pop music or, you know, contemporary music question that I wouldn't get right. Okay, thank you. Stan from Eminem. So hip-hop artist, Eminem. We're done.
Yeah, we could turn this into just a general like etymology podcast, if you prefer.
Well, it would be Marshall Mathers meets Marshall McClure, I think.
Of course. Any direction you want to take this, by all means. There are lots of rabbit holes and deer holes and crocodile plover holes we can go down here. But
nice. That's great.
Let's get back to The Genius. So you said that you recently rewatched this season two. What was your take on it now, watching it a few years on, and how did that differ from the first time you saw it?
Okay, my thought on it from when I watched it just now is tremendous fun. I love The Genius, and Sangmin's in every episode, so you gotta love that. The entertainment value is there.
A not premature, I guess a post-mature spoiler alert. We will be talking about season two as a whole and possibly referencing other seasons as well. So if you're someone who is just following along with season two as you watch it and you're listening to this, maybe turn back now, bookmark this for later.
I am going to spoil. Notice I didn't say Sangmin wins. I said Sangmin is in every episode. Russell Hance is in every episode of two seasons.
And he won both of his seasons, so I'm not sure what you're talking
about. I don't remember that.
There might be some fake news there, but we will be talking about both season two as a whole and possibly jumping back and forth with other seasons too. So bookmark this for later today when you finish watching the entirety of The Genius and you can come back to this and enjoy it.
Nobody can do that in a day. Nobody should do that in a day.
I wonder if it's like a very rich ice cream where it's wonderful, you like it, you want to have it, but you can't gorge yourself on it in one go. You have to just let it digest and simmer for a bit.
I worked with a brilliant producer in Hollywood once who said, the mind cannot absorb what the ass cannot endure.
that's a perfect way to put it, I think. But
and then the producers of Sleep No More, like, we have a different idea.
God.
You'll never sit and you can't understand anything.
Anyway, in any case, Sangmin is in every episode. You watch every episode again.
Yeah. So a number of the main matches are duds. And there's probably more bad main matches in season two than in any of the other three seasons, probably.
Let's get into that briefly, because that's not just you saying that as a fan who happens to be watching the show. That's you saying that as someone who designs and hosts games as both a hobby and a profession. So.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I would probably just, like, as the TV watcher, Like, there's the game that's basically Pit. You remember the card game that you play at the cabin and it comes with a bell that you ring, Pit? It's a tabletop game.
Right.
It might even be public domain. And so then that becomes the cornering game, right? And nobody even plays that game because they're going for the thing that's in the safe. And Sangmin's just like, give me all the bombs. Give me all the bombs and I'll win. And everybody's happy to get rid of the bombs. I think even if that game had been like, so no, that game didn't get played properly, but even if it had been played, like, what's the thrilling version of that game? Yeah. So that game, I mean, that was, the thing is, like, all these things are good TV, but the games are a little bit lacking. And some of the, I liked all the death matches, but some of the death match performances are not that good. But oh my God, do I love God's Judgment, that whole episode. And I really love Hong Chul.
Of course.
And I really love Food Chain. It's just a very strong start to the episode.
God's Judgment really works because you know there has to be some kind of trick to the game. The genius would not have this contest where it just reduces to this randomness of who can get the best roll on a die. You know there's a trick.
And well, it's open pass. They found a way to do open pass a second time without doing open pass. That's the...
That's the beauty of it. It's not surprising that it's Sangmin who ends up finding, who ends up solving the riddle. But you're sitting there as everyone goes up there and they're placing their markers and they're rolling all these different numbers and you think they haven't figured it out, but someone has. And when we see who it is and how they did it, it's gonna blow our minds. And sure enough, Sangmin comes through as he always does. But I think you highlighted something which is noticeable as the show has evolved over its four seasons. So in season one of The Genius, most of the games are quite simple on the face of it. And even when beneath the surface there are lots of layers, so the Capture the Burglar game, for instance, the basic format is very easy to understand. But then when you think about all the implications and where should the burglar go each time and how should we be trading the burglar back and forth, there is a lot of detail you can get into there. And we did on our season one coverage. But
you picked a great example.
Yes, but to me, those games are so iconic because you watch them and you know what they're about. And there might be some trick that shifts your whole perception of that later in the episode, but you can follow along from the first second of the episode, knowing roughly what's going to happen and what the terms are. As the show has evolved, though, in season two and especially season three with things like the Stormy Stock Market, the Miners game and so on, there were lots of these games which are very... mathematical in the sense that if you're sitting at home with a notepad working through all the permutations, you can have the satisfaction that you figured out the game, but there's no
you
hook.
Can Dom you
okay
can. Not everyone can, but that's something I really admire about you, and I'm glad that's why you talk these things through the way that you do.
Well, thank you, Miles. But the royal you in this case, you can sit there and you can figure these things out. But I don't know what the hook is meant to be. I don't know what the hashtag epic blindside is. I don't know when extreme ways is meant to drop, because the game just doesn't really lend itself to that kind of thing. It's if you figured it out, if you have a human there, right? They're going to figure it out within 10 minutes. And
yes,
okay, good for them. But there's for me as a viewer, there's no mic drop moment. Whereas a game like Food Chain, it's still complicated. There are so many details. It can be hard to follow at times, but it's exciting the whole way through. And the format of the game naturally and very perfectly lends itself to that in a way that a lot of these games simply don't. So I see Food Chain as almost like a bridge between the simplicity of season one and the complexity of some of the later games. And it plays that role to perfection in my book.
That's very well said.
Anything to add there? Because I feel like I'm just going on at length, and you're
no,
the authority
not at all.
Figure.
I don't think you've been going on enough. So when you think of Food Chain, like, what floats to mind? The good and the bad of the game and how it plays.
What I think of is this seems like a kind of game which you could play it 100 times with the exact same group of people, and you would have 100 different outcomes because there are so many different permutations of the roles, and then the way those roles interact with each other, you have enough agency within your role, but also your goals are so different that, depending on which player gets which role, you have a very different game and therefore a very different TV episode. I think to some degree the producers struck gold that Hui Zhong drew the lion. Like, if I was a more cynical man, I would wonder if there was some engineering going on to make sure that Hui Zhong drew the lion, because that's so perfect
Dealer Nuna is not going to permit any chicanery.
Dealer Nuna is beyond reproach. I will hear nothing bad said against her.
Who needs standards and practices when you've got the icy cold stare of Dealer Nuna?
Of course. But Hui Zhong getting the line is so perfect, both for him, for the opening of the season, and just for the way the episode plays out. But you can imagine if, let's say, Jung Hyun was the lion instead. You have an equally amusing episode, but for very different reasons. So you can shift all these players around and get these very different outcomes, whereas I don't know that the same is true of, not to keep bagging on it, but Stormy Stock Market, let's say, or the Miners game. It's within those games, each player has pretty much the same kind of role. They're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're on different teams or something, but that's you roughly know who the important players are going to be. In this game, how important you are is defined not just by your role, but what you make of that role and which other players you team up with, whether you get lucky or unlucky with certain events. So there's all these different things coming together to make this this perfect recipe.
Yes. What else?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here, Miles.
Well, shall I, while you compose your thoughts, shall I tell you about my personal history with Food Chain?
Please do, yes.
So the first time I saw this episode, I was just so gobsmacked by this game for all the reasons that you mentioned and others besides. It just really hit the spot for me. And I was having dreams about it even. And so at the time, along with my friends Willa and Lily, I had started a club in Los Angeles, and it was called Play Folk. And I started it, well, the three of us started it because there were all these games that I wanted to play that weren't nearby. Or that you needed a group of people to play. That was really all you needed. They weren't nearby, as a misspeak. And we played games like Tombstone Hold'em, which was a game that I read about in Jane McGonigal's book. And we played Circle Rules Football, which is like an it's like a sport. It's a field game that is mostly popular in Brooklyn. I would say a lot of Play Folk was me wanting to make LA more like Brooklyn. In some ways.
Is that really what you would want? Or
at the time, yeah. I know I've never lived in Brooklyn, but I feel like I have a pretty good idea of the good and the bad. I have a pretty good idea of the good and bad of LA. I lived in there for 18 years. And yeah, but the club was, one way to put it would be trying to make it more like Brooklyn. Just insofar as Brooklyn's got circle rules football. And what does LA have? We just got NFL football, which I'm glad I got out when I did, and I live in Berkeley.
Well, the UK doesn't have circle rules football either, so...
Are you sure about that? It's an international game?
Maybe there's a closet group of enthusiasts out there that I'm not part of, but if they are...
Would you play?
I'd give it a try. I'll try anything
okay,
once.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to find the closest circle rules football team to you, and you got to go show up and play, and then we'll compare notes.
Well, if I ever end up in Berkeley, I'll take you up on that.
Oh, I don't know who plays around here. Probably a lot of people on the Cal campus. So anyhow, so I used I invited people as part of the Play Folk structure to come observe my birthday at my house by playing Food Chain. And I needed 13 people. And the way I figured it, with just like the materials that I made on you know Microsoft Word, was that I was going to need 5 refs, one in each of the 4 habitats, and one master ref. And that meant that I needed to get 18 people to RSVP and not cancel. And we were successful. We actually had a few extra people came. So there were people who played the first game and not the second one. And the reffing was a little bumpy on this first occasion, but that was not the last time we played Food Chain at my house. We did it again the following December. And then we did it again in February. It was Valentine's Day. We were like, well, what would be more fun than whatever the more traditional items are. And so we called it Food Chain Eat Your Heart Out. And everybody came over to play Food Chain. And since then, I've played it at USC. And I've played it I've played it here in Berkeley. I'm going to sort of save that for a little bit later. But so I don't know how many times the game creator of The Genius played Food Chain before it aired. But I think that there's a possibility I may have hosted and produced this game more than anybody in the world, because you know I've run it multiple times, including some instances when I reffed the whole thing by myself, just running from habitat to habitat and consulting my notepad and being like, "You attacked her, nothing happens. You attacked him, you are dead," and so on. So I can tell you, if you want to ref this game at home, a couple of things to keep in mind. The most important rule that the players don't understand involves returning to your home habitat. People just have a hard time absorbing that. It's not difficult, but people have a hard time absorbing it. Do you know the rule to which I'm referring, Dom?
I do. I get a sense that a lot of viewers watching for the first time didn't really register that either. And I know that when we were trying to like break down the game and analyze all these different possibilities, one of the things we kept forgetting and had to rework to accommodate was, oh yeah, they just can't be here for this round because they have to go back to the forest or the field or wherever their habitat is.
Yeah. And if you don't have, you know, the enforcing that, sometimes it kind of has to just be honor system. But there is a way around it, which is you just, like, when you check each habitat, see who's there. And you don't have to note who is there. You just have to note these players must be there the next turn because you, as the ref, somebody will have to go to them and be like, you are not supposed to be here. And that's before, like, the official count-in begins where people can attack each other. In my games, I thought that the physicality, the part of the attack sticker, was not important, but not necessary, but important.
I saw in your write-up for it that you use post-it notes, which I think is a good compromise to strike there.
Yep. You just stick a post-it note on somebody, and if you both do it like right when the count-in timer starts, then you rock, paper, scissors, which... Gura would not consent to. No way is Gura going to do rock, paper, scissors. It would really bump him out.
I'd like to think there are no health and safety concerns with post-it notes, but people find their ways, so who knows?
No, just, I did explain that, like, you know, it's not a combat game. You can't escape the post-it. If somebody wants to attack you, then they will. Something that you brought up, which is you could play the same game with the same group of people scores of times. Well, it's interesting how the peeking works, because after you learn your own identity, you can peek at one or two other players depending on your role. And, you know, people do join up with others and say, well, let's not be redundant. Let's agree that we're going to peek at these other people and compare our notes. And there are people who their identity will never be secret because everybody's going to peek at them and everybody's going to share them. Usually this is a player like my friend Tripp. You know, he's very smart. He's a formidable player. And I think he was intimidating to the other people there. So people always peeked at him and it became hard for him to achieve his win conditions without the veneer of secrecy. But Tripp's very bright, so it didn't hold him back, too much. But I really do like playing with people who have never played before. Because it's a very thrilling experience to watch people make the decisions and see who just this whole time had a knack for it, but they never knew it until now. Because a lot of it isn't so much bluffing, although bluffing can be really good. A lot of it is like convincing other people to delay gratification. Like the basically the don't eat me move, the don't eat me now move, you know. That's a really good move. My wife is really good at the don't eat me now.
I like that the game opens itself up to that kind of social manipulation, if you like, because for some of these games, if you're on different teams, let's say, you might come up with a good strategy that mathematically is sound, and maybe that gives you a 60-40 shot to win the game or something. But within those teams, maybe there's a struggle for dominance, or some voices are louder than others. But really, it's you know who's going to take charge. In this game, everyone is relevant to some degree, and so the whole game could hinge eventually on whether the crocodile and the otter say the right thing at the right time, or they end up in the right place. So you end up with these fun pairings. So let's say you have a couple in the game, and one of them is the hyena and the other one's the lion. So they have diametrically opposed win conditions. They can't both win at the same time. How do you handle that tension? Right? So you, regardless of what group you play it with, like your group with lots of friends who know each other, maybe a few couples in there, lots of good friends, that's going to be very different from 13 strangers that you gather in a TV set to play the genius, right? But both of those can lead to interesting outcomes.
Yes, and the truth is actually Food Chain does suffer a little bit by the fact that there's not going to be a loser, a death match, and an elimination. Right? Like the way you're going to play it or make deals with people, knowing that you're going to have to continue to play with them in the the structure, the aegis, the metagame that is the genius. If you are never going to see them again, you know, it doesn't matter that much. much. But, you know, that, so the play is different, but, you know, it's good. I mean, you could say any, like, there's nothing at stake, but people are excited to play, and some of them are, you know, like, driven to win.
Yeah, I guess you could put something on the line if you're so inclined, but also, if you get a competitive group together, they will find a reason to want to win. You don't need to offer them anything. They will will happily try and screw each other over and trip over each other to get a win.
Yeah, and you know it's you're right about that. The incentive, the prize is not. I never once have I done that. Everybody, like, basically when you get eaten, you go to the dining room where there are snacks, and then you get to eat. And we had to, I think, like, one of the first times I got eaten, I sat down and started eating snacks and, like, loudly talking about, you know, what I had gotten out for. And people were like, duh, don't, the dead shouldn't talk. And I was like, right, the dead shouldn't talk. Whoops. So, you know, it's not fair to the eliminated player. But just like on The Genius, there's food, there's snacks. So when you get eaten, you get to do the eating. So people, you know, that was like consolation for the guests at the party. Yeah,
you come full circle. But maybe there's a perverse incentive there. But if your snacks are good enough, you want to get eaten so that you can now partake in those instead.
Yeah, my friend and my business partner Greg was the, like, I think it was the first game, or he was the eagle, and he did not go to the sky in the first round, and a crocodile ate him. And so he was eliminated, like, immediately. And then he was like, oh, well, bye. And he left the party. But we had extra people. But he just, like, the eagle is a very good role. You're the only predator who can go to the sky. I just feel like you have to mess up pretty bad to lose so quickly as the eagle.
I strongly agree. And when we talk about the individual roles, I'm sure we'll get into that. But maybe the answer is that everyone carries some snacks around with them. And when you eat them, you get their snacks. It's like a bounty.
Now, I'd like to give people thematic snacks, like we would give the eagle. I would have given Greg a bag of mouse feet to eat. But the problem then is that you would look at who's eating the mouse feet and you'd go, well, that player's the eagle. Plus, I feel like there's already enough details to take care of. So yeah, everyone should get the same snacks, trail mix and madeleines.
Yeah, we don't want to turn this into a gross food challenge. We've got enough of those as it is. Yeah. But let's get into the game itself here, because I think the basic format of it, you can make some modifications, and maybe, let's say, if you're playing it divorced from the context of The Genius, where there's no future metagame to worry about, maybe that involves making a few changes to the game to accommodate that, or maybe you think some roles are overpowered or underpowered. So just based on the game as presented, what's your take on how well it's designed and how well it holds up to scrutiny? So if you have a bunch of players who are very savvy, very good at solving this kind of game, is it still enjoyable and deep enough for them?
My opinion is yes. Each experience, like, as the ecosystem, you know, makes the different moves, it holds up. I actually never made any adjustments to playing Food Chain. I just kind of felt that the original game was, like, to me, sacrosanct. And people have said, like, oh, well, if you only get 12, you know, you can drop one roll. But my feeling is, like, no, you don't, like, start a game of chess with one too few pieces on the board. And so it is with Food Chain. I think taking any one, even the crow, like, oh, the crow makes a guess and it's a coin flip. But the crow can go to the sky and be food for the eagle, or it can be the difference between the hyena starving or not. I don't think that there's a role that you can strike out. But again, my friend Tripp, who is the person who introduced me to The Genius, and a great puzzle and game creator, said that there is a problem that relates to the four prey animals and their ability. And it also involves the eagle. I guess the eagle keeps coming up. And the mallard is one of the four. If, like my friend Greg, the player who is the eagle dies early on, then the mallard is heavily incentivized to go to the sky, her home habitat, in all four rounds, guarantee her own survival. That then makes the combinatorial power for the otter, deer, and rabbit impossible to attain.
Yeah, so as a refresher, if all four of the prey animals are in the same habitat, they cannot be killed, or rather, if all surviving members of that group are in the same habitat, then
of that group of four prey animals, it's not just any prey animals, and that is a part of the rules that if stressed properly, people do get the home habitat thing is what trips them up, not this. That it's not just any prey animal, because there are 9 prey animals. This ability does not apply to chameleon, crow, Egyptian plover. It's just those four, and one complaint about food chain is that remembering otter, mallard, hare, and deer is hard to do.
To me, and sorry to jump in, but the way I've always come to remember that is by process of elimination. So the others all have this very distinct role, and then whoever is left over, it must be them who are the four the group together.
That's a good way to think of it.
But I agree. If you're looking at the game for the first time, especially if it's in the context of the season opening of The Genius, when there are so many other things just overwhelming your senses, it's hard to remember, it's exactly these four in these locations, and if they go here, then you just don't even register that unless you're some super genius.
But had you observed that about the mallard's disproportionate advantage because it can go to the sky?
I had, and I noticed that in the context of, I don't know if this is a flaw, but it's certainly something that's worth noting. When we talk about needing to leave your habitat, there's no corollary of you can't stay in your habitat for more than one round. So you have to always come back to your habitat. But if you want to, you can just stay there. If you're a predator, you have something of an incentive to keep moving around, so you have this stock of prey that you can follow. If the eagle dies and you're one of the sky... you're one of the other animals that can go to the sky, just go there and chill out for a bit, if that makes sense.
Except for the crocodile plover, the Egyptian plover, whose home habitat is the river. I did not notice that on my first couple watchings of Food Chain, that although it can go to the sky, its home habitat is the river. I love that. It's so yummy.
To me, that really breaks that breaks some of the elegance and the symmetry of the game. Not to quibble with the food chain board expert here, but to me,
love it. Tell me more. Tell me more. Criticize the Egyptian plover.
Okay, so there's this natural symmetry to the game where you have these four different habitats, and it makes sense which animals should start in each habitat. So of course the birds are going to be in the sky. Of course the crocodile is going to be in the river, and so on. And then you have this extra disclaimer that most of these animals, if not all of these animals, can't go to the sky unless that's their habitat. And you think that would be the natural rule. However, you have this one animal which, it's a bird. Okay, I understand why it can go there.
that's where you sabotage your argument.
All I'm saying, there are flightless birds, Miles. Okay, if there was an ostrich, that's not taking wings and leaving out of the sky.
Well, that's a solid point. I can't dispute that. Okay,
thank you. I think it's so much more intuitive if your home habitat is not the sky, you can't go to the sky. It's off limits. And knowing that there is one exception, I don't think it makes too much difference to the game, but it's just this kind of thing which you're going to forget at some point, and it's going to throw off all your calculations. And when that happens, you don't think, oh, wow, I got outsmarted. You just think, oh, yeah, of course, I just forgot about that. So to me, that's a little wrinkle that doesn't need to be there.
That is a well-stated opinion. My rebuttal is birds go to the sky.
Well, okay. Some of them. Look, fine.
Some of them, yeah.
If there are any ornithologists out there with hot takes, by all means, write in and set one of us straight. But for now, we can leave it to rest there.
Okay, but then it'll be a bird that arises from the ashes of a hot take. So it'll be a phoenix.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the only one animal fits that description.
Beautiful. So what was your take on this breakdown of roles? Because one of the downsides of having a game with so many distinct characters is that it's very easy for some of them to be too good or too bad, or maybe even worse, just too inconsequential to the game.
The mallard was the only thing that didn't, that I once Trip pointed out, I saw that the room for improvement there. But, I mean, you get the lion who has this frailty he has to eat in every round. But he, somebody's got to be at the top. And the mouse, the mouse gets two peaks, and it doesn't matter if it lives or dies. So the mouse is not really a bad role. You got the lion looking out for you. You got the same symmetry. And, you know, I love that the, I don't know, like crocodile and eagle, I think, are in the right place relative to each other. I mean, one of the things that's really cool about this game is that, the zoology of it all, you know, it does flow intuitively. So that's pretty fun.
Yeah, because if you compare this to the layoff game later in the season. So when we talk about Food Chain, we talk by extension about the layoff game, which is a variation on the same theme. And you would think, when you get to that point in the season, having already seen a game like that before, having just seen more of the genius, knowing about the pacing of the show, how it tends to work, and then also getting a better sense of who these characters are, seeing them play eight games up to that point, and and the familiar faces from season one, you would think the layoff game would be so much easier to understand. However, everyone that I've spoken to about this season has said Food Chain, despite all of those barriers, despite all of that, was so much easier to understand than the layoff game. And I think part of that is what you said of the evocative imagery that comes with it. You understand why the eagle has to go to the sky. Maybe not why the crocodile bird has to go to the sky, Miles. But anyway, you understand why that has to be the case.
I'm going to read the comments section. They're going to be on my side.
But you don't understand why employee A in sales is linked to employee B in marketing. Like, that's not an intuitive connection.
That game is so terrible. It's just terrible.
It doesn't help that I don't think they actually explained the rules fully either, so you're left to just fill in the gaps.
Didn't care.
At that point, it's, look, we've given you enough good stuff already. You'll put up with this, all right? Just let us finish the season. And
it's true.
They're
it's
not
true,
wrong.
We did.
Yeah. But it's a shame, because I feel like if you just ran Food Chain back with that same remaining group of players and the season one players, that would almost be more interesting. It would be like like, just go back to Scamming Horse Race, right? Go back to Middle Race and Middle Race Part 2.
Middle Race, boy.
Maybe just don't go back to Middle Race at all, but you see what I'm getting at here.
That one's tough to follow. No, of course, that would have been much better. The show is not flawless. Bum Diddly Umps just responded to my tweet and supplied the name of this television producer who makes all the games that we like so much from Society Game and The Genius. And Bum D said, but here's the thing, though, is I read it. I think Bum D said the name was Jung Jiong. The only thing I feel sure about is the initials. So from this point forward, when I talk about this person whose work I like so much, I'm going to use the name JJ and the pronoun they and them. And that's my choice. And, you know, everybody else is free to do what he or she wishes.
Perfect. So if you could talk to JJ, what would you tell them?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I'd be too bashful to tell JJ any of my criticisms, but
are you a JJ stan?
I'm more of a JJ Oliver. That is a Laurel and Hardy joke.
Beautiful. So if you
Oliver Hardy's friends all called him Babe. That was his nickname. That was what Stan called. Stan Laurel. My wife's name is Laurel. I'm a Laurel Stan.
Okay. I will call you Miles instead of Babe, if you prefer. But regardless, what would you tell JJ if you were able to have a sit down in the office with him? Or them?
Whatever their
mystery identity is.
Yeah. JJ and Bum D are on an island somewhere. Boy, that's such a sobering thought that rattles me down to my boots. If JJ was like, let's work together, I'd be like, okay. If JJ said, well, okay, let's see. Here's my question. All right. Yeah. I have another category that this could flow into, and I'm trying to decide whether to hold back or not.
Never hold back, Miles. Mm-hmm. Just go into it.
Okay. Is there anything else we want to say about the roles or the different habitats? Anything that's specific to Food Chain in this episode, because I'm going to take kind of a hard left turn that you might not see coming.
There's a lot to talk about, but we can circle back to that. I don't want to.
Okay.
I don't want to wait for whatever this this blindside is now.
So I worked with Professor Elisa Grossman at USC, and she invited me to come help out with a project. And it's her project, so I don't think I should say too much about it. But she and I both watched The Genius. She helped me ref the very first ever game of Food Chain. And she is also, you know, she's the creator of the LA Crosswords Puzzle Tournament. And, you know, she's a very, very smart person and a good friend and my neighbor. And we're talking about, okay, if you were to do a game of Food Chain that wasn't Food Chain and that also wasn't the layoff game, you know, what would it be? And I said, well, what if you just took this dynamic of predators and prey and you moved it? So instead of the African Sahara, it was like an underwater, like aquatic dynamic. And she said, did you just come up with that on the phone? And I said, I guess so. Yeah. And she said, I hate you. But then I reached out to my friend Jacqueline, who is a marine biologist, and she did not play Food Chain, but she's a big board gamer, and she understood what I was going for. And we talked about the pyramid because I said, well, of course, you know, at the top of the pyramid, you're going to have a shark. And she said, no, you're going to have an orca. And I said, an orca like a killer whale, like Shamu, like Free Willy, orca eats shark. And she said, orca eats shark. I said, okay. And that's why when you listen, when you ask the scientist a question, you listen to the answer. So you've got this food pyramid where the apex predator is the orca and the secondary predator taking the role of the crocodile is a shark. And then you've got the third predator. Now in the game of Food Chain, you've got a bird that can go to the sea, and you could do that in this game. But what if it wasn't a sky habitat that the third predator can go to? Can you think of what I'm thinking of, Dom?
That could be like an island or something. But
That is correct.
Oh, yeah. Okay, perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And so that third predator should go on land. And in the draft that I worked on, it was a polar bear.
I love it.
So you can picture the orca eating the polar bear if you want to. And you can picture the shark eating the polar bear. Then you've got a scavenger who would be in the position of the hyena. And I went with eel, which I think has this great connotation. So now you've got the four predators at the top of the pyramid, and then you need to fill in the nine prey animals. Well, there's this whole deal with the otter, the hare, the rabbit. No, the hare, the rabbit are the same thing. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
What if instead they had some distinguishing characteristic, and what if they were the seahorse, the sea star, the sea cucumber, and the sea lion, which is the one that can go to the land habitat, and so is the equivalent of the mallard.
So there the names provide this unifying feature that you can identify what those four are.
That is correct. And although there is a turtle in the game, and technically it should be called a sea turtle, in the game it is only called a turtle, because the turtle is not part of those four. And you can probably guess who the turtle is corresponding with.
I actually can't, so spill the...
Think it over. Turtle can go to the land, so it would have to be a bird from Food Chain.
Sure. You're putting me on the spot here.
I am. You want me to tell you?
Tell me.
Perhaps you can guess.
As we've already established, Miles, I can't
guess. Like the crow. It's the crow. The turtle is the crow.
Okay. Can we return to the part here where the shark and the whale can go on land and just eat whatever they want?
No. Why can the shark and the orca go on land? They can't.
Oh, that's a sky equivalent. Because you said earlier that, if they come and eat the polar bear or something, but I guess...
If the polar bear is not on land.
Ah, so if the polar bear gets greedy and ventures outside, it can get eaten.
Yes, and since the polar bear, like the eagle, can only starve for one round, you know, it very well may want to venture afield. But yeah, the polar bear is hard to mess up, same as the eagle.
Okay. I like it. And I imagine there are so many different skins you could put on this kind of game. So you have this aquatic-themed game that you brought up. You have... I guess it's more wide-ranging nature theme that they went with for the real genius. But you can imagine lots of different variations on this. And as long as that hierarchy intuitively makes sense, then I think the game works. So we talk about Food Chain being much more memorable than Layoff for that reason. Mm-hmm. But if you scrambled the roles, if now the otter was atop of the food chain and the deer was going to the sky, and if you just randomized everything, it just wouldn't make sense anymore, and it wouldn't be as fun or as easy to follow.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In the same way that I think it was, you know, I can't remember, it might have been Benjamin Franklin said, it's easy to publish the most accurate dictionary in the world. Just take the current most accurate dictionary in the world, find one error, correct it, publish, and now you have the most accurate dictionary in the world. Along those lines, I was like, what if I take Food Chain, which is like this great game that I hold in such esteem, and I make a couple very small changes, but changes all the same. You know, then from an IP perspective, you know, that it is an original game, but it's clearly, you know, the changes that I made, I'm actually pretty happy with. And this is a game, as I've said, that I hold in such high esteem that I was, you know, tentative to make any changes. But there is this issue of the mallard that we talked about before. And so the animal in R4, the sea lion, which is correlates to the mallard in Food Chain, it's one of the four that can be invincible if they're all alive and they're together. And it is the one that can go to the island. And in fact, the island is its home habitat. If the polar bear is eaten early in the game, then the sea lion could just go to the island all four rounds, like the mallard going to the sky. But the new rule is that the sea lion's win condition has two conditions, which is it has to be alive at the end of the game, and it has to visit the open ocean, which is a different habitat, corresponds to the field, once before round four. So in rounds one, two, or three, with this condition about any round that you spend away from your home habitat must be followed by a round in your home habitat, which is the island. In rounds one, two, or three, the sea lion has to go to the open ocean or it will starve. And so that's my adjustment to get over this imbalance for the mallard. What do you think about that?
I like that because it creates a sense of inevitability. So I know I have to go there at some point. If I wait until the last round, then any predator that's left in the game knows that they can just follow me there and get a guaranteed kill. So mm-hmm. I probably should go there earlier, but then the same argument for going there in round three also applies to round two, or maybe I maybe I get that out of the way right away, go there round one, and then I have the freedom to explore as I please.
The last player who was the sea lion did that and was very successful.
Yes. So if you're willing to take that risk up front, it could really pay off later on.
Could lose the game in round two without being eaten. If in round one you go to the island, which is your home habitat, and in round two, let's say you choose to go to the kelp forest, well, you're going to die because you didn't spend round two in your home habitat. So you have to go to the island round three, which means rounds one, two, and three are over, and you didn't go to the open ocean. So you, by choosing to go to the kelp forest after the island, you die in round two. You don't even know it yet. You're a walking dead sea lion.
I guess also, so I have to come back to my home habitat once every two rounds, effectively. So if I go to the open ocean in the first round, they know I have to come back to the island, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. then there's still a level of predictability there, even if I can't fully avoid that. Mm-hmm. So it's just this guessing game, I guess.
That is anybody who knows who you are.
Yes.
And I have found as a strategy to people playing this game, paying super close attention to who is in which habitats is really important. And something that I saw, I do feel like I learned something new every single dingle time I watch Food Chain. And I was thinking about that, like, while our Skype call was connected. And I was like, is that a figure of speech? The last time I watched it during this rewatch, what did I learn? And I actually did. There's an answer, which is they have monitors in their rooms that tell them which player is in which habitat. I didn't realize that before.
Yeah, that's so, public information.
Well, it is really useful information.
Well, so here's the million-dollar question, Miles. Is the game better or worse with that public information?
You know, I'll say this. The versions I've played at my house didn't have it, and it seemed fine. But maybe the next house game I play will have to have it.
Because you can imagine that if you have two rounds worth of information, you can try and reverse engineer the game and make these educated guesses about who can be in which roles. But There are so many possibilities that you can't narrow it down perfectly. So you're thinking, oh, okay. So if person A is in this role or this role, that means person B is in this role, unless person C is in this role, in which case, and it just continues on. And so you can end up just making these very risky plays based on these reads, which might turn out to be wrong. And that adds this whole new type of variance to it, I suppose.
By knowing more about who went where. The way we do it is that when time is up, when the strategy round ends, I say, okay, hold up one finger for, if we're doing this reskinned version, you know, one finger for kelp forest, one finger for ocean, one for island, and one for coral reef. It wouldn't be one. It'd be 1, 2, 3, and 4. I was concentrating on remembering the names of the habitats, and I forgot how to count to 4. But you hold up the number of fingers based on which habitat you're going to go to. And then that's like honor system. So then, okay, everybody walk in that direction. What you're not, it's the equivalent of, since we can't have them lock it in with the dealers. It's sort of honor system. What we don't want is for somebody to walk into a habitat and somebody else goes, well, I'm not going to wake up my mind until I see which habitat they go to. That's not how it's supposed to
work. Yeah, there's a logistics issue there. If you see someone coming out of the room to go to their new habitat, then you already know where they were before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I guess depending on how your house is laid out, that could be an issue. But also, as you said, you never want to be the first to act. So if you get more information based on who goes where, that might inform your decision. So you need everyone to have to act at the same time.
They act at the same time. But, you know, currently it is open who is going where. You can look around the room and look at people's fingers. And so I didn't think about it until you said it. But yeah, you can see what room people are returning from.
Yeah,
that's really important too. That's good. Okay, good. I'm glad my players haven't been suffering.
I guess also if that information isn't public and you have to work that out for yourself, that creates this extra incentive to talk to other players. Like if you were in one room, they were in another room, you want to know, oh, who is in your room with you? And so, that person was in my room in this round, so now they have to go there. So it creates this extra collaboration between players, which I think is always fun. There was, on the timing issue, one of the problems I had with the original Food Chain game was you had this weird thing where I think it was in the last round, you had a predator and one of the 4 unique prey animals in a room together. And so whichever one of them struck first, they would get the kill. And then all of the other prey animals, because there are only 2 left, the remaining one would be the last one standing by default. That would be all of the prey animals. So their predator would not be able to kill them. You had this weird timing issue in the game where whoever just place the marker on their prey first would win and the other predator would die. So I don't think that's a good thing to have in the game. It adds this physicality to it that you don't really want to have. But I guess you just have everyone issue their commands simultaneously.
I suppose it's possible that somebody's gotten screwed over by that in one of our games, because not like the kills aren't necessarily measured in synchronous time, but if it ever did happen, I'm blissfully unaware of it.
I bring it up because we had it in the actual Genius, where I think that's how it Yu Young who got screwed over by that.
And that's how the fellow in the A's cap managed to win, I believe.
G1, the fucking pumpkin.
One, yeah. And when you're playing this game with your friends, if you ask people, so like, let's tell each other what animals they are, people a lot of times are not going to want to answer. And then if you try, what I try to do is just be like, okay, well, just tell me if you're predator or prey. And people don't want to do that either, because they don't want you to know if they're a prey, and they don't want you to know if they're a predator either. But I have found that if you ask people, well, okay, let's just share information, but just like partial information, tell me what your home habitat is. People will give that information up, and that information is really useful. So that's like, if people don't feel like it's a big ask, because they're like, there's a ton of animals in the field. So my tip to future players is ask people that information. Pay attention. You can tell who's who.
Okay. And so when you've run this game, it's with the same, or roughly the same social circle, right? Or it's with people who know each other to some degree already?
This game that I played most recently, the Under the Sea version, there was nobody there who knew more than 2 other people.
So I guess that's useful then. So in that case, how does that differ from those cases where it is an established group already? Do you see different roles play in different ways, or it, does the game feel different in any way?
They're all pretty different. I mean, like this last time we played the game twice, and in both games, the orca, the apex predator, the lion, died in the first round. And you know, it almost makes me think, like, is the lion actually a weak role? But I think that has a lot to do with like how the players played it. As it happened, I told you, you know, you still need a lot of people, and we played it at my house, and we had 13 people, and I reffed it by myself. We had a couple extra people, and after we played the first game, we got started pretty late, and there were some people who had to go, and we were like, okay, well, look, we actually do have enough people to play one more game. I can ref it by myself. The only way we'll have enough is if we've got a couple people here who are sort of like plus ones and said they didn't want to play, but we're going to ask you to please. And then my son, who is 6, and his friend, who is 5, the two of them will have to be a character. The kids can play together. And everybody consented to those conditions, and so we played. And it was totally random draw, and the kids drew the orca, the apex.
Oh, wow.
like kind of the same way you were saying, like, Weejong. Like, oh, I wouldn't have expected that would happen. And so my friend Lily, who is the co-founder of Playfolk with me, she was the equivalent of the mouse. She was the animal who supports the orca. She is the remora, which is a sucker fish. And so she guessed the name of one player. And, you know, it really benefits her to know who the orca is. And she guessed somebody and learned something that was not useful. And then she said to herself, well, the kids are probably going to out themselves. Actually, no. What are the kids? I said, you guessed correctly. The kids are the orca. So in the first round, the orca and the remora and one other player all went to the same habitat. They all went to the open ocean. They were the only three there. And Lily, thinking that she would help the kids, and here's where she may have thought ahead just one step too many, because she's like, look, I'll attack this animal just to make sure it's not the poisonous prey animal, which is the snake. But in our game, it is the fugu, the puffer fish. That was one of the two suggestions that Elisa Grossman of USC was very sure about, that the snake should be the fugu. The snake should be the fugu. And so Lily said, well, I'll just attack this animal, make sure it's not the fugu. And if it's not, you can eat this animal. And you can eat me on some other turn. Well, you know, you might say, yes, but then what if it is the fugu? Which it was. So Lily attacked that third player and died. And now the two children, the orca, had the choice of either eating the fugu or starving to death. So it did not, for one glorious round, the kids had all the power. And so that's an instance where actually, like, the simple solution's probably better. Lily goes, hey, kids, eat me. And there's that one round that they're not going to starve in. It's probably a better test than let me attack this just in case. Because, you know, she guessed one other player, and there were a bunch of people who she knew weren't the fugu, and that wasn't one of them. But anyway, I mean, who's to say in that position I might not have made the same mistake? I'm not bagging on Lily, but I thought it was a pretty funny story.
I love that. I can imagine now just having a kid's birthday party where you played this, and it would be absolute pandemonium, I'm guessing, if you had the right group. But that's what I think the beauty of the game is, that it works with whatever character of group you have. And
yeah,
so depending on who you have, like a group of corporate executives playing it is going to be very different from a kid's birthday party, but you're going to see the same basic format lead to such different things.
And if anybody who is listening to this works at, I'm going to do sort of the ad here, which is, if you are listening to this and you do work at a company and your company has ever done a team building event, that means your company is likely to do another team building event. And it could be my company coming to play Food Chain with your company or something else. But go to my website, milesnye.com, and learn more about that. And I think that's the end of the ad.
Perfect. So, well, I will gladly aid you in your advertising efforts. So is this a current offering that your company does? Is this like a standard thing?
No.
That, okay.
No.
But if they rang up and said, hey, Miles, do you want to be paid to make a food chain game for us? You're not going to turn them away, right? You're going to say, yeah.
Well, you know, when you put it that way, I'm like, I'm really in it for the art and the satisfaction, but I will settle for the US dollars.
And I just don't think you could satisfy my artistic needs, so I'm going to have to turn you down.
I got to walk away. I'm sorry. I have to Marlon Brando this Academy Award you're offering me.
But so how would you adapt this game for some kind of professional setting then? If you were offering this game, you were pitching it to clients, how would you make it either more marketable or maybe more enjoyable for a certain type of clientele?
Well, I think I'm already positioned to do as is. I'll tell you the biggest change, or not the biggest change. Here's what I would do. I'd say you could have one or two people playing each role, so maybe you can get more people involved. And then when the game is over, I want us all to pull our chairs into a circle and not play seat exchange, but just gab about what we just played and in what ways were the way you played with your coworkers like the way that you work together, and in what ways was it different? And how did it feel if you failed in the game? And how does this organization address failing? Or does it? Do we all just pretend that nobody who works here is ever going to fail? And that's probably more than I would say if I were actually there, because the act of pulling the chairs in a circle after you play a game and gabbing about what it means, that is great. That is a very sexy conversation to be in. And I'm very proud and lucky every time I get to facilitate one of those and get people just listening to one another in a different context.
Yeah, Food Chain might be very well suited to that because it forces this very special and twisted hierarchy on them. So if you have someone who just, if you have the receptionist working as the lion and the CTO working as one of the prey animals, that's inverts the usual dynamics in a way that could be very interesting to see. But I think also the game is, it's just naturally very good for any kind of social mixer, right? Because it's, you have all of these different groups randomly forming in different places at different times.
And yes.
And so it's not just you turn up with two of your friends and you stick with them for the whole game. And maybe you have to work in part of a team, but you get to sit back and let someone else do the heavy lifting. You have to get involved. You have to be out there talking to different people, getting to know them, and learning to work with them suddenly based on this new information that hopefully you're getting from them and other people.
Yes, it does end up, I wrote like about a, in addition to all this gabbing, I wrote like a 3,000 word blog post about the first time I played Food Chain.
Which we will link in the show notes, by the way, for anyone who's interested in that.
Sure, yeah, then you should read my Sleep No More blog post. And in it, you'll find the observation that this game, through great contrivance, does what parties do naturally, which is little cliques of people gathering in different parts of your house. It's pretty cool.
And it almost helps in a way that there is logistically enough downtime that you will just be there with people and the game is on hold temporarily. And so you get to just talking about stuff. And it's,
yes,
it's not as if you're in there and then out the door again and there's no, you know, chance to actually just sit down and take a breather.
You're getting me all excited to play the game again, because like the last couple of times that I played, I've just reffed, and that's it's an aerobic reffing. It's like Jeff Probst, you know. You're really covering a lot of ground, especially because I have a 4-story house that we play this game in.
Humble brags, Miles, especially in California.
It's this weird Berkeley Hills, because it's like it fits into the hill, so they're like 4 small stories that are like one room each, connected by like a half flight of stairs.
It's like some kind of a haunted house that you'd go in. You could take your house and convert it into some kind of like play experience, right?
Yeah, this would be good for that, especially there's a good view of the sunset, so especially around twilight. Well, for those who have been paying very close attention, I've left 2 threads dangling. But they're both the number 2. This is the Jinho thread, which is that I said that I made 2 rules changes between Food Chain and my version, and that Elisa Grossman had 2 good suggestions right from the jump when we first began talking about this. And those both relate to the shapeshifter character, who in the original Food Chain is the chameleon, but in this version is another aquatic master of disguise, which is the octopus. And the octopus's adroitness at camouflage is used to great comic expense in Finding Dory. And I was partway through working on this when I saw that movie, and I was like, oh, this is perfect. Hank, the septopus. But just that, like Elisa sent me a YouTube video. It's like, look at this octopus camouflage. I was like, I am sold. But that ended up just through the natural course of things, creating this other adjustment. The chameleon can choose to disguise himself as the eagle, but he can't go to the sky. The octopus could choose to disguise himself as an animal who goes on the land, such as the polar bear, but the octopus can actually go to the island to make his disguise more convincing because octopodes are okay on land. Their home is in the water. Yeah, that's, I don't say octopi, that's just too lowbrow. The plural of octopus is octopodes. I don't know if that's correct. I think that's like Greek. But they can go on land. So the last game that we played, the octopus disguised herself as the fugu, right? Always a solid choice. Be the snake so the people won't attack you. But then in the first round, the octopus went to the island, which she can do, but not if she wants people to actually think that she's the fugu. So it was very easy to attack her.
Yeah, let's talk about the chameleon or octopus or that shapeshifter role, because I think that's one of
Yeah.
the more you people get mad at me when I say more unique, but I'm going to do it anyway. Well, it's one of the
That's
more
fine.
unique features of Food Chain, and I love having that role in there because it means you
Yeah.
can never be sure about anything. Because
That's right.
having that
Yeah.
one person who could be lying means that if your best friend is telling you that they're the eagle, well, maybe they're the eagle, or maybe there are two eagles out there that are
Yeah.
giving contradictory information, and you have to now decide who they are. And for those of you who have ever played Werewolf or the latest craze, Secret Hitler, getting that kind of conflict between two different players who are directly challenging each other's claims is so good for just energizing the game and getting things more exciting. So I love having that. And there's also a real element of strategy to it too, because you could disguise yourself as anything. And so, do you want to pretend to be a prey animal? Do you want to pretend to be one of the predators? If so, which one? Do you pretend to be one of the birds, knowing that you maybe can or cannot go to the sky equivalent? And what does that mean for you? Or do you pretend to be the snake? Do you say, no one touch me, I just want to survive, and I'm going to take the risk that no one's going to call my bluff, knowing that there's at least a 50-50 shot that I am actually the snake, at least in theory. Do you have any thoughts on what the role of chameleon does to the game, and then also what you should do if you're the chameleon, eh? What the right strategy is?
I'm going to answer the second question first because the chameleon is so fun. It's a super important part of the game. And the somewhat sad truth is it doesn't make much sense to disguise yourself as anything other than like the snake or one of the predators. But I could be wrong about that. But as far as what it does to the game, just as you said, it introduces the possibility that your information, when your already limited information, is false. Like the authentic information that you get from the dealers. Have you played the game Two Rooms and a Boom?
I haven't, but it sounds fun.
Oh, it's great. Oh, yeah. It's by Tuesday Night Games in Texas. And that's Night with a K, which I think was a mistake from the branding. But it's a very fun game. And it's just like something that could be on the Genius. And they have a print and play version available. And it is a game somewhat like Werewolf, where there are different roles. And one of the roles is Shy Guy. And if you get dealt the Shy Guy card, you can't show your card to anyone else. And what that does, you're not allowed to. Other people can exchange, show each other their cards to gain trust, or just show the color of their card to establish team loyalty. The presence of Shy Guy means that every player can go, no, sorry, I want you to trust me, but I can't show you my card because I'm Shy Guy. And everybody claims to be Shy Guy. So that's great. I mean, Chameleon creates the opportunity. It's like just as the lion has this frailty, like he'll starve if he goes one round without eating. You know, if I am the snake and I choose to peek at you and the dealer tells me Dom is the snake, then your bluff didn't work because I peeked at you. and I know that you're the chameleon. So like the risk of the backfire is there. It doesn't make a lot of sense to disguise yourself. Honestly, I feel like Snake and what do you think? Does it make sense to disguise yourself as one predator more than the others, or is it basically like the gold medal goes to Snake, the silver medal goes to, it's a four-way tie for the predators, and then the booby prize is everything else? Or am I wrong about that?
I think you're right. Let's say you pretend you're the lion. Well, you can't, like, if you just don't eat someone for a round, which you need to eat someone every round, or your cover's getting blown pretty quick. So
that's a good point.
I guess maybe that's an argument for the crocodile first, or maybe the hyena first, even. But you can imagine these convoluted plays where, like, you pretend to be one of the four prey animals, the otter, the deer, and so on, so that, like, you lure them to one place thinking they're all going to be immune from the shared safety, so that one of the predators can come in and eat them because you have an alliance with that predator. Or, like, you could, if you figure out what animal the crow picked, you could bluff that, or if you know what they're likely to pick, you could bluff that animal and then, like, lead them astray or something. So there are lots of ways you could play it, but I just love having so many angles to the game, and I wonder if that's one of the things that you would want to rebalance, so that there is a better realistic range of animals you could pick.
Well, yeah, that would be a pretty significant difference. I just found that the new choices that become available by making the shapeshifter able to go on land, I think it's actually better. And those choices can be good, like convincingly disguising yourself as polar bear or sea lion, or they can be bad, like disguising yourself as Fugu and going to the island. Or bad as in, like, if your disguise is seen through, then you kind of wasted the thing that's most special about your ability, because when it gets right down to it, you're actually just another prey animal. And I think what you said, you know, much earlier in the convo about the sort of being a gap between a game like 1-2-3 Election or Zombie from the first season and the more complex games that came in the later seasons, and Food Chain kind of being in the middle. And I think that that's really spot on. And I think that one of the ways in which it is shown is in the range of choices. You have quite a few choices, but it really actually just boils down to habitat, pick one out of four, and then once you get there, attack or don't, and if so, whom. So that's more choices than 1-2-3 game, which is simply whom first, and then, you know, whether, then whom, then which card. And that's only going to be one of three at the start, or, you know, one of three kinds. It's only ever going to be one of three kinds. And then the much higher number of choices in some of the late, yeah, like, what was another one? We keep coming back to Stormy Stock Market, but or a Middle Race. Oh my God, the number of choices in Middle Race. Too much. Too much.
So Miles, if I want to pay you to hold Middle Race, my company, is there an extra fee for that? Or what are we talking about?
No, I'll do it. I'll do it. I mean, you know, like, give the people what they want.
Yeah, I think Food Chain strikes a good balance of being complicated enough that we can have this hour and a half long conversation about it, but not so deep that it's Middle Race and no one would want to have that conversation about it.
Yeah.
Maybe I would, because I'm weird like that, but you see my point. It's a lot
very
more
much
obscure.
So.
Yeah.
I need to like read a white paper on Middle Race before I could have a conversation about it. But Food Chain, just in case you couldn't tell, you know, it really resonated with me and it's kind of got under my skin, and it's so much so that I've made something totally, you know, I've made some, not totally, that would be a misnomer, but I've made something new from what I discovered in Food Chain.
Yeah, if someone out there wants to take a deep dive on Middle Race, then reach out and let me know. But for now, we'll stick on Food Chain.
This is the right podcast.
And we'll move on to one of the other roles that is very distinct, and that's, or just distinct, I don't care, and that's the snake, which... The snake's mm-hmm. goal is to cause as much drama and destruction as possible. So it's a perfect role to throw in there. But I wonder how well you think it's calibrated. So the condition is that nine or more players are dead in the end, including itself. Or it can include itself. And
that's really important. Well, no, it can't include itself because the snake cannot die.
Oh, of course. Right. So Yeah, so in terms of the way the game plays out, you have 13 roles, including the snake, which means only three other people can survive. And that sounds like a pretty small number on paper. How do you arrive at that figure of exactly nine? Is that the kind of thing which you, if you're JJ, you run 10 iterations of this game with different counts there to test how often the snake wins, or how do you calibrate that?
That's the only way I know how to do it, which would be to see what's like hard but gettable. Hard but gettable, you know, over the course of multiple games. Not only is the snake going to be alive at the end, so that means that, you know, you're looking for not 9 out of 13, but 9 out of 12. But it's actually not. It's 9 out of 11 because there's one member of the Fab Four that is always alive at the end of the game. The way I ref that game is that animal survives even if they attack the Fugu, which could be controversial. But if the other three are dead and the remaining the seahorse attacks the Fugu, as far as I know, that animal cannot die.
Well, also, the seahorse or its equivalent wouldn't have a reason to attack other animals anyway, right?
No, it would not. Unless it was trying to help the snake, unless it was trying to help the Fugu achieve its goal. And I have seen that kind of thing happen in my house games. The very first time we played it on my birthday that one time, the screen grab from which I had printed the rules out had a different translation that just one instance, or like wherever the source material was, it didn't say nine or more. It said more than nine, which is a very big difference.
Massive, yeah.
Yeah. So like when you say like, well, what's the best way for JJ to do it? Like, you know, you test it out and you find that like more than nine is not really, it's got like nine seems about right. Because like the snake or Fugu seems to win about half the time, I have found, which, hey, really suggests that the balancing is done well.
You can also, if let's say the three players left in the room are a predator that needs to eat, one of the however many prey animals and the snake or the Fugu, that predator has to either eat the Fugu or eat them, and they might decide, I want to drag that predator down with me, so I'm going to immediately jump on that snake. And here's a timing thing coming into play again. I'm going to immediately try and attack the snake, get killed myself, and now that predator is out of life.
I've starved the predator. Yeah. Anytime you starve a predator, you are making it bad for them, because even the hyena can only starve twice.
Now, let's think about the crow quickly, because as it turns out, this role goes to Junghyun, who I think of as the perfect crow. This is a role where you make your choice, and then you sit back and watch and hopefully quietly facilitate. And he's perfect for that, but you can imagine, let's say, the crow was Sangmin, or the crow was some other more aggressive player. They would be getting in there and doing everything they could to help out their chosen one. Now, is the crow overpowered in the sense that if any other role is overpowered, you can just pick that role and your chances are now tied to theirs? So if there is any imbalance in the game, having the crow in the game exacerbates that.
Well, yeah, because the crow gets to make a bet, but then gets to also like be part of the outcome. So the obvious example, or ace, you know, pretty clear example, is if the crow chooses the snake, then the crow can say, hey, you know, kill me and let's work together to get a bunch of people dead. The crow doesn't have to be alive to fulfill its win condition.
Yeah. Or the other possibility that we discussed was we thought the eagle was maybe the best role. The one downside to the eagle is if it has to return to its habitat every other round, well, so do the other birds, but then there are also no other animals that can just wander in there haphazardly and get eaten. And the crow can just park there in the sky, wait, and so the eagle is guaranteed a source of food as and when it comes back.
Yeah. So that's right. It's very good for the crow to choose the eagle, but the eagle is a very good role anyway.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, because we flagged that up earlier. Is the eagle the best role? Because this was my theory after going through it all. That seems to be the consensus, and it would validate me to know that you're on board with that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you mean when you say the best role. Like, if you could cheat and get dealt yourself any card you want, you should ask for the eagle. I mean, if the eagle goes to the sky in the first two rounds, there's really no reason why the eagle shouldn't survive into round three every single time, because any bird that didn't go to the sky habitat in the first round has to go there in the second round. So if you the realistic worst case scenario is you're the eagle, you go to the sky in round one, no other bird goes to the sky, they all fly to the river instead. And I mean, I guess they could all get eaten, and then none of them can fly to the sky in the second round. But any bird that didn't get eaten, aside from the Egyptian plover, is definitely going to fly to the sky in round one. So you might starve in round one, but you're very, very unlikely to starve in round two if you go to the sky in both rounds. And, you know, by this point, you should be tracking who the birds are and where they are. So, yeah, winning as the eagle should be pretty easy to do. But Greg is very smart, and he, you know, kind of like I feel like Lily and the orca, maybe overthought it. And so, you know, a really capable player with a role like that. And that's what's great about it is that, you know, you have these, you know, players who think themselves out of good decisions, or nutty players who make, you know, bizarre choices that then confound the well-made plans of the other players. That's really fun. You know, the eagle is the best role, except for the chameleon, which is not as good as eagle, but it's super fun. And except for the snake, because you get a bunch of people to die. And except for the, like, there's a few excepts. But yeah, the eagle's the best role. I understand the question, and I agree with the answer.
And that's why the game is so good. There is no categorical answer of, oh, yeah, of course it's the eagle. How could you not figure that out? Do you have any more thoughts on just the way the game was designed in practice, the way it should be designed, or the way the episode came together? Because I think the episode was the perfect way to kick off the season. And part of that is the game, but part of that is also the cast of characters and just the excitement of having a new genius season. So what did you make of that overall package?
So good. I mean, that's definitely in my top five episodes of The Genius across all four seasons, episode one. And it's not just that Food Chain is really, really great. It's all those things that you mentioned. They'd never done a rehearsal before. That was the first time that there was a rehearsal, and that was great. And G1, I mean, in that first episode, you know, before G1 is a rich snob, G1 is in an A's cap, and after they explain the rules, he screws up. He's like, okay, is he done talking? Like, after Bandage Hung tells them about garnets, G1 is like, is he done? And then I think Jin-ho is like, he's going to tell us the rules of the game. Like, you've definitely seen season one, but you forgot Bandit Chung's going to tell us the main match. So sure, she's not done talking. And then he finishes explaining the rules, and G1 goes, I don't understand. I don't get it. These games are too hard for me. He's alone in a confessional, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. And then he gets the hang of it in the rehearsal. And then he has such an exciting game as the rabbit in the main match.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. He's so good. I actually said, this is a reference that absolutely nobody understood, but when I played for the first time, I said, I quoted G1. I said, please let me be the snake. I just want to muck about.
That's a deep cut, Miles. Come on.
Yeah. My mom was there. She was one of the refs who were giving out the rules. Nobody knew what I was talking about, but me and Bumdy God, and your listeners knew what I was talking about.
We all understand and appreciate you, Miles. Don't worry.
Thank you.
But yeah, this episode really just works on so many levels. And I know that season two is...
I thought you meant this episode of the podcast, and I was going to take all the credit.
That too, yeah. And you would deserve to take it. But this episode of The Genius, it works on so many levels. And I know that this season as a whole is generally regarded as the worst season. It's usually ranked as the worst or the second worst. But to me, this is, excluding the grand final, which as an all-star season is kind of in a class of its own, this is so special to me just because this game really drew me back in, reignited my love for the show. Because you watch season one and it's amazing. That you want as many seasons of the show as you can get your hands on, but you never know if they can live up to that same level of quality. And then you see this open season two and you're like, okay, my doubts have been assuaged. I'm in.
Yeah.
And you stick with it.
It's really, it's such a strong punch, yeah.
Yeah, and I might disagree with the season two doubters, but to me, this is the one episode that even those doubters, even the haters, can all agree is one of the best. It's up there.
You have this episode and you have God's Judgment in this season. I mean, I know something has to be in fourth place if you rank the seasons from one to four, but, you know, I, I think that there's so much good on the one side of the scale that just, you know, a few crummy main matches and really like pretty much all good death matches. I don't know if there's another season that has as little tactical yutnori as this one, which is none.
You still have the blackout game, which is maybe not the best. But I take your point. There's
yeah. The blackout game is a perfectly good game, I think, except it was just, you know, transparently hacked by Yunkyul. You know, but like, I think that's kind of the same as the, you know, some of the other, you know, like the way that, Jungkyun, played, same picture hunt in this game. Like he, you know, he just so handily beat it, that it was an effort to make it exciting. It was exciting, but it took some doing.
Certainly.
Yeah, it's and like so you in episode one of season one, you've got the 1-2-3 game, which is classic and perfect. And then for the kicker, you have the Garnet Heist. In this, you're like, okay, what are you going to do? You're kicking off the season. This is the most people you're going to ever have in a game. You know, this whole season, what are you going to play? It's not 1-2-3. What is it? It's Food Chain, and it's wonderful. And while you don't have a Garnet Heist, you do have the forest field thing between the mouse and the lion, which I think is like you. What you get is not the Garnet Heist, but you get Hui Zhong saying, "It's over. We've won. I feel bad for the viewers because we're going to win so handily."
Oh, it's
and then he goes home in the death match.
It is such a perfect quote. I should have it up here. Yeah, he says, "I can't lose. The game is over. The game is so overwhelmingly won that I almost feel sorry for the viewers." And I don't think any of those viewers felt sorry for him when he met his comeuppance.
Yeah, he got his comeuppance. He got his just desserts for his hubris and his overweening pride because he was the lion. So, of course, there was pride.
that episode, it's so perfect. I want to go back and rewatch it again now. I'm doing this mostly based on memory, but after this, I'll put that at the front of the queue because it's
good. It's a good standalone.
It's so good.
Yeah.
So that, I think, covers most of what we have to say about the episode. I want to ask a general question. So your experience as a game designer, as an event designer, I imagine you have lots of groups. They're not playing Food Chain necessarily, but they're playing games like that. They're playing games designed to explore different sides of themselves, designed to get to know each other. What goes into designing that kind of game to maximize that potential?
The genius, don't forget, is, you know, it's a competitive series that's really like testing the limits of the player's intellect. Like, it's supposed to be very difficult, very challenging, right? So for my clients, I'm not going to run the mental equivalent of Wipeout. The game, honestly, like the games that I share with the players are usually much, much simpler by design. You know, whereas a game of the genius is really going to benefit like one person who figures it out and gathers a larger group together to get rid of somebody from the smaller group. Like that's, you know, that's repeated in almost every game. The benefits that I'm delivering to the clients are better illustrated by games that get everybody working together. So it's kind of like I get to appreciate this aspect of the work that I don't really do. I wouldn't say, you'd be mistaken to say that I'm running games like Food Chain in my professional capacity. I do that for fun. But the closest, I think, is an event that company has run for a few clients, and it is a game called Haggle. And the game designer is, for some reason, I want to say Hal Holbrook, but I know that's not the name. So it is, I'm looking it up in the book here, Sid Saxon. I was trying to say Sid Saxon, and what I said was Hal Holbrook. It's not so bad. It is a game that would be perfect on the genius where you get some pieces. It's a lot like Scamming Horse Race. You get a few poker chips and a couple pieces of information that might be along the lines of red chips are worth twice as much as a blue, and you must have at least one green or your score is zero. And then you can exchange chips and share information with the other players. It doesn't have to be at a one-to-one basis. You don't have to accept trades that other people offer you. And when time is up, you hand in some of your chips and you get a score. That is one that I have run with players before. And what's great about it is wide open. Like, that's every rule. You just let people, and there was a huge, the first time I ran it, there was a huge, these are all people who worked together, and they said, I said, you have 1 hour, and that's it, go, here are your chips, here's your information, do what you will. About 40 minutes into it, one guy was like, hey, my team is moving, is proposing a collective. We pool all the information, put it face up on the table. And all the team, there were like 60 teams, and all of them except three agreed to it. And those three all were teams that had a piece of information that was like a poison pill that they wanted the others not to know. And they dispatched spies to go look at the table with the face up information on it. The winning team was one of the teams from the collective, which I thought was good. And I think I'll probably end on this. We are packing and preparing this game, and we are game designers, and we are also the producers. Logistically, we have to be clear on all the details and the aspects. So we were running this game, and we'd never done it for a client before. We knew that it was sound, and Greg, business partner, built an awesome spreadsheet. He built it himself that you can just type in how many chips each team has of each color, and it will adjust because there are like combinations of chips that like curse other teams' scores and make it go down, and there's ways to defend against those. So like what other people have in their stack that they hand in affects each team, so they all like are interrelated, and Greg had it all reflected in the spreadsheet. And we were packing up, and we had these really slick silver briefcases, like mini ones, toy ones, and what they actually were, they are the Deal or No Deal home game with all of its contents discarded. And we put the poker chips and the information in these briefcases. And I said, well, okay, we're going to drop off one briefcase on each table. The tables are numbered, and I think it was like one to, I don't know, maybe it was, I don't remember how many teams it was. Maybe it was only like 24. And the tables were numbered 1 to 24, and that we just had printed out these table toppers with the numbers on them really big. And we were like, well, when they handed the briefcases at the end of the game, the briefcases all look the same. And when we're stacking them up and counting them, we need to know which team is which. And I said, well, that's fine. The rule will be, and there's very few rules in this game, but one of them is the game when you hand in your briefcase. Your briefcase must contain the table topper from your table that has the number on it. That's how we'll know which table you were at the beginning, and that's how we'll know who the winners are. If your briefcase with the tabletop number is not handed in when the countdown timer is zero, then your score is zero and you're disqualified. So this game is underway, and the players are making a big, a big collective, and people are sharing information. A lot of people are just behaving randomly and with no logic or thought whatsoever. Because they don't get to do anything like this at work. So they're just being wild and having fun for no reason. Because it's like, I'll give you three reds for one black. Why, do you know something? No, but exchanging chips is more fun than doing nothing. So they're just, behaving kind of wild. And I was like, oh, I had this thought looking around there. I was like, oh, well, if this were an episode of The Genius, then what I should be doing right now is going around to every table and stealing the tabletop number. Because then everybody else's score will be zero, and I'm the only team that'll hand in a briefcase. Fortunately, nobody in the room thought of that because I would have outlawed it, but so I think I was the only person in the room who was dark and twisted enough to realize that that is probably what Sang Min would do.
I think both watching and designing games like that really twist the way that you see them, so that if you were playing with a completely novice crowd, you would just be looking for all of these angles that wouldn't even occur to them, or that they would think would be kind of impolite to look for. So I remember playing this urban game where the idea was you had this central gathering point, and you would have these agents with playing cards like dotted around this area of the town, and you would have to locate them, get a card, and make your way back to the meeting point while avoiding these trackers who are looking to chase people down. And in theory, you were meant to just come back, get your cards, and then at the end, whatever poker hand you can make with those cards, whoever had the best hand would win. And I was thinking,
Good,
well, so you could form alliances with other players to just trade cards. Like, that's the basic thing. But then also, you could, like, try and enlist passers-by to sabotage people who you don't want to get certain cards who aren't in your alliance. You could try and, like, lie about what your cards are. Someone did this to me. So we were going to trade cards, and naively, I didn't force them to expose the card before we traded, so they just stuck me with a card I didn't need. So there are all of these things that, like, if you have that cutthroat mentality, you just play the game. You're playing a completely different game, basically. So I still had a lot of fun, and so did everyone else. But it's like, I'm not sure how much our experiences of it really overlapped to the same degree.
Well, you were just in a different class than everybody else.
Well, I was outclassed by them, certainly. So that was true. But yeah.
Well, then iron sharpened iron, and now you are ready to go and do unto others as was done unto you.
Perfect. I always love, because people know how obsessed we are with the genius, so whenever they run home versions of some of these games, they often tag us in it and show us what happened. And I adore that. I just love seeing people try this for themselves. And I know I've CC'd you in some of these before.
Yes.
I think the best example was Adam Klein. I think his brother ran like a home version of the game, which was very well received. But even, I think someone, I think it was their 14th or 15th birthday party, they just got a bunch of their friends together, played some of the games from the Genius, and they showed us that. And I love it. I'm glad that I was able to bring something that was so enjoyable to me to those people that they could replicate for themselves, and then I now get to vicariously enjoy it through them again. That's so beautiful to me.
Keep throwing those parties, keep sharing the photos with us, please.
Yeah, I'm tempted to try and run something like that myself. I don't know who with or where or how, but discussing this now and hearing about it again, I really want to make it work. So maybe that's my task for 2018.
Okay. Can I ask you, I'm going to ask you an ignorant American question. How far is your home from Manchester?
Pretty far, but I can make it there.
Pretty far. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe I'll introduce you to some people I know in Manchester.
Oh, by all means, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Well, Miles, is there anything else that you want to plug, or just get out there into the universe before we let you get out of here today?
Yeah, the two things I name checked that I would encourage the diehards to follow up on are Million Dollar Mind Game, an ABC game show that I helped contribute to. You can find the whole thing on YouTube, and Bothers Bar. If you just search for that, all one word, you'll find the website for Brig Bother. And if you click around, you can find the YouTube series with David J. Bodycomb and Brig Bother, which was Schlag den Brig, which my understanding is a play on Schlag den Rob, which my understanding is a German game show called Beat Rob, where you have to beat Rob in a series of games. I guess it's like Win Ben Stein's Money. But this, instead of Schlag den Rob, you have to Schlag den Brig, you have to beat Brig. And it's a very long YouTube series, and I loved it. So those are worth watching.
And of course,
my opinion.
And I'm assuming Only Connect is on there too, unless you've fallen out of love with it over the past few months somehow.
No, are you nuts? Did you listen to my Only Connect game on the RHAP B&B?
I did, and I would recommend everyone else go and listen to it too.
I'm as in the tank for Only Connect as I can be, but I don't want to be, I know, I don't want to just bang on and on about Only Connect when there's other shows to share and spread the love about.
There are lots of issues I have with the UK, but the one thing we do well is obscure game shows. That's our niche as a country.
Game shows and panel shows.
Yes. They seem to be very popular national exports as well. Like a lot of them, even some of the more obscure ones have gone international or have this cult following elsewhere in the world. My first love will always be the Genius, but there is some sense of national pride that we can deliver stuff like Only Connect to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pantos I don't get, but it's probably just lost on me culturally.
I don't get those either. I think it's lost on me culturally too. Perfect. So, Miles, where can people be finding you if they want to reach out about this or about anything else?
I'm on Twitter at Miles Nye, and trying to be a positive voice for progressive and feminist topics on Twitter, but also tweeting about Survivor and game shows and gameplay. And and my website, milesnye.com. And you can go to my professional website, wiseguysevents.com. You can also get there from my website. And I attended this really great conference in San Francisco this past weekend. And maybe if I say that, I'll write a blog post about it. Because there's a long blog post about, there's one about food chain, and there's one about Sleep No More, and there's one about Secret Hitler. But it's been a while since I wrote one. I think this conference I went to would be something good to share with people. So maybe if I say it, it'll commit me to writing a blog post. Although I do have a child who's 2 months old. Last time I was on your podcast, there was some possibility that my wife is going to go into labor. Now I'd say there's a near 100% certainty that she isn't.
I would hope so, yeah.
Yeah, well, if it was going to happen, it would happen, because I think we're wrapping up and we're saying bye-bye.
Before you go, give us your parting thoughts on Secret Hitler, because this is a new craze that has swept the nation and every other nation, apparently, too.
It's new. Look at the date on my blog post for Secret Hitler. Secret Hitler is not new.
Yeah, no.
I guess it's...
The genius wasn't new either, but you didn't feel the need to tell us about that, Miles, so...
Secret Hitler is great, and I love what the team that built the game has been doing with their platform. Did you know that they mailed a copy to every member in the United States Congress?
Ah, I didn't, but that feels very apropos.
That was after the election of 2016, and they said, look how different it is, look how difficult it is to maintain a united front against the invidious rise of fascism. So I like that. And as far as gameplay, yeah, I mean, I like it. I like games like Betrayal at the House on the Hill and Two Rooms and a Boom and Werewolf, where there is a traitor. And I have some friends who think that the issues that Secret Hitler brings up by making it about Hitler and fascism, like by name, are too touchy. And I get what they're saying, but it doesn't actually bother me. I mean, like, I watched the only Mel Brooks movie that I like is The Producers. And I think, you know, if you can laugh at The Producers, you can laugh at a game that's called Secret Hitler.
Very well. Well, on that note, Miles, I think we'll get you out of here. Thank you so much again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. And feel free to hit me up on Twitter and let me know what you thought about the incredibly long-winded amount of things that I had to say.
Awesome. And for the rest of you out there, if you want to contact me, I'm on Twitter at DomHRV. Colin, in absentia, is at Colin Stone. You can find us, Dom and Colin, at...
Do you ever podcast with him anymore?
We're taking a break, okay? We're seeing other people. We're podcasting with... we're podcasting with other people, but I'm sure we'll get back together at some point.
Is that sincere? Did you guys have falling
out? No, absolutely not. But it's... he has this weird schedule and timing. I do as well. I mean, it's 6 a.m. at this point, so I'm still here talking to you.
right, I forgot about that. Yeah, thank you for saying that.
I'm committed to the cause, Miles, okay? I'm here for you.
Oh, my God.
But certainly when the Survivor season comes back around, we'll be doing that every week. And there'll be other stuff we'll be doing together. But for now, I have some other stuff coming out this week. I think he has... some random stuff in the pipeline too that he hasn't told me about yet, so that will surprise me just as it surprises all of you. but thank you for listening to this. Thank you for listening to whatever of that content or his content you end up listening to, and we will talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everyone.
Bye. Fighting.